everyone, Megan Francis here. So you've probably already noticed that there are some big changes to this podcast, namely that it's no longer the Kitchen Hour podcast. We are now called the Home Hour podcast. Several reasons for this change. First of all, I found that while I had always intended this to be something to keep people company in the kitchen and keep moms and dads inspired and entertained while they were cooking dinner, a lot of people were letting me know that they were listening to the podcast all the time. They were listening in the car, they were listening while they worked out, they were listening while they folded laundry or while they worked during the day. And so it started to feel a little weird trying to sort of pigeonhole my listeners into listening during a certain time of the day when you can listen whenever you want. That's great by me. The other thing is that I'm finding that a lot of the people that I was bringing on, the interviews and the guests on the show, really covered a wide range of topics, all having to do with home and family. Some food, some parenting. And I really wanted to make sure that the title of the show encompassed all of the different things that we talk about so that people who find it on iTunes aren't confused. I think that there were some people kind of coming on and thinking it was a food show and then being confused that it wasn't. So we're definitely still going to talk about food and kitchen stuff a lot, but I'm also going to keep delving into other kinds of guests, other kinds of topics. I've got some regular co-hosts I'm going to have coming on in different kinds of topics like mom and style and wellness and other things that are going to become a regular part of the show so that we can really delve deep into those topics. So keep your eyes open or your ears open. There's going to be some changes coming over the next month or so. All good, all exciting. The heart of the show will always be the same, but I'm really loving podcasting and I want to make this show even better. And I want to make it something that's really entertaining and inspiring and informative for everybody. So stay tuned. Things are going to get really exciting here. One other thing you should know is that the show notes are going to be in a different place than they were before. TheKitchenHour.com will no longer host the show notes going forward. You'll find them just right at my blog. It'll be at thehappiesthome.com/whatever episode we're on. So in this case, it would be thehappiesthome.com/episode19. Also, we're going to be doing the show on Thursday rather than Wednesday from now on. There's a lot of reasons for that, which I'll go into today's show notes. But just keep in mind that from now on, the show will come out on Thursday. So if you were subscribed to the Kitchen Hour, it should seamlessly just switch over to the Home Hour and you should still get it first thing as soon as it goes up on Thursday, usually late morning or early afternoon. So I want to jump into today's interview. Today I'm featuring a conversation with Karen Pittman, who is an author and a blogger. Her blog is called Planting Dandelions, and she had a book out by the same name a few years ago. We talk about everything from parenting and writing to food and grocery shopping and vintage recipes and a whole bunch of really fun stuff. You're going to love it. So welcome to Karen. Hi, Karen. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Megan. What a nice way to spend Friday afternoon.
Oh, that's good to hear. So for the listeners, Karen and I, we informally met at a bar. We were in New Orleans at the Mom 2.0 conference a few years ago, and Karen was reading from her book, Planting Dandelions, and was so awesome that I got a little writer crush on her and then ran up to her, and I said something really sort of incoherent to you. And then the next year when I ran into you again at a different conference, I then made a bigger dork of myself by reliving the experience of running into her and saying something incoherent. So despite all that, she seems to like me and now we're friends.
Yay. Yes, you're charming. Both times.
Oh, well, that's good to know. Yeah. I felt more goofy. So Karen is a writer with a capital W. I say that because I just am really impressed with her talent. She's got a really great blog that is very conversational and friendly in the way that blogs ought to be. But then she's also a memoirist and an essayist and is working on a novel and is awesome. But we're going to talk about all that later. First, we're going to talk about food. Karen is working on a project right now that is the Stenopad recipes. Is that what you call it? You just told me this and I've already forgotten.
Yes.
Okay. So talk about that a little bit.
So the Stenopad recipes is actually a collection of recipes written in a, as the name would suggest, written in a steno pad. And the backstory is that this was a steno pad I pilfered from my late mother-in-law's belongings after she passed away relatively suddenly and certainly unexpectedly when I was pregnant with my first child, which he's now 15, so that's how long ago. And I didn't get to know my mother-in-law, Millie, real well. She died when I was still new in my relationship with my husband and new in my relationship with this country. So the absence of her has been something that I felt very strongly throughout raising her grandchildren and my relationship with her son. And she was a very forceful personality, a true Southern matriarch. And one way I've gotten to know her is through her recipes. And I decided after years of using the steno pad recipe collection to make the things that Patrick really remembered vividly from his childhood and growing up, I decided, you know, there was still a lot of things we hadn't tried, so that I would go through it in a more systematic fashion and just deliberately make everything in it, make it the way she specified, and then report about it on my blog. So it's a way of connecting with my mother-in-law and in a way to hopefully, well, literally nourish my family and her descendants with her cooking.
Now, one thing I think is really interesting about this is that you you're from Alberta, right?
Actually, no, Newfoundland, east.
Newfoundland, that's right. You told me that before. So Kieran's a Canadian living in the South, which I just think there has to be so much culture shock there, and the food must be different, at least, than what you grew up eating and your own mother preparing or your own family or church banquets or wherever you were eating. Is that the case?
Yeah. Oh, huge. I mean, the culture shock just from north to south and Canada to U.S., we need to shutter everything down and just take, you know, a week to sort that out. But
right.
I'll be sorting that out for the rest of my life. But the food alone is, well, there's two things going on in the gap between my food experience growing up and what's here. So one is a cultural. I mean, Southern food is iconic, and it's hard to think of any other American cuisine that's, you know, has that kind of influence on the idea when we think about American food. So often those dishes are quintessentially Southern. So, you know, it has a well-deserved and well-earned reputation as being a cuisine very rich in, well, rich, period.
Right.
Rich in story. It's a storied
right.
cuisine. But then on a more personal, individual level, I grew up in the 70s. You know, my mom was, I wouldn't say we were just, you know, totally crunchy granola, but she was very health conscious. I had to go, you know, to my, you know, spend Saturday mornings hitting up my neighborhood friends for sugar cereal and, you know, things like that weren't really generally found in our home. My dad was the gourmet in our house. So he was strongly influenced by, you know, the whole Julia Child's gourmet revival era. And so he would cook. When he cooked, it was a big production. Mm-hmm. Lots of gourmet, ethnic foods. You know, he just destroyed the kitchen, which, of course, my mom, who was the, you know, sous chef designate, I guess, would have to come in and clean up behind him. But so I grew up with this, you know, with more sort of exotic foods on the one hand and then healthy foods on the other. A little bit of traditional Newfoundland cooking. You know, obviously there's some particular dishes to that area. But Patrick, my husband, grew up, the dietary style in his home was just free range, pop, processed, sugar, you know, refined stuff, things made with, you know, can of soup and, you know, in this and a can of that. And his mom was a wonderful home cook and made lots of things from scratch, but also was a working outside the home mom. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with convenience, canned biscuits and convenience foods and box mixes were part of his growing up. And I have always had a really strange fascination with that kind of cooking. I mean, gelatin salads really are the most exotic thing I can think of, you know? I just love those recipes. I would sit... I talk about like food porn. That's kind of my version of food porn, is to sit and pick up these, you know, estate sales. You find these like ladies auxiliary club, you know, spiral bound cookbooks. And I love reading those recipes. You know, they're disgusting, but they're fascinating.
Well, it's funny, you know, it's what you were saying about Southern cooking being so iconic, and that's totally true. And there's some things that you could definitely say are Southern. Like, I mean, I think that when I think of peach pie, I think South, although we make peach pie in Michigan, or when I think of barbecue, I think South. But it's funny because when you started posting those recipes, I had just, and we talked about this a little bit, I had just found or refound, I guess, a very mid-century cookbook that had been given to me when I was a baby in the 70s that was written by, you know, the church ladies. So they were probably all by that point in their 40s, 50s, 60s, and so on. And so it was like, though there was a lot of, although we had some weird things like woodchuck and, you know, squirrel for two.
Right.
This was the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, so very remote. There was a lot of sort of similarities, I think, between the way everyone cooked in the 50s and 60s and 70s. Yeah. And so those gelatin salads, you know, those were happening in the Midwest and in the South. And those weird combinations of those casserole things.
Like, those things. So,
yeah, those things.
Little casserole, like
right. It's so.
When you break it down.
I kind of wonder if that was like the time, and I'm not a food historian, but I would like to figure this out actually because it's just popped into my head. If those were the decades where food started to kind of like come together more, like the where the regional cooking started to come, you know, together as one, and the church ladies in the South were cooking the same sorts of things as the church ladies in the North. I don't know the answer to that, but it would seem logical.
Yeah, it does. And I think, gosh, it would be interesting to talk to a food historian about it. You know, in the way that the 50s, you know, that really brief period of that century came to define domesticity, like our idea of what, you know, 20th century domestic living looked like. And really, there was much more going on, you know, but just the 50s, probably because, you know, advertising and, you know, the baby boomer generation, that just came to define really the 20th century, the way we think about our grandmothers and mothers in the kitchen.
And suddenly everyone had access to the same packaged foods
right.
as well.
Right, so a can of mushroom soup showed up in everything. And I've got several, I've had to work around that for some of our traditional Thanksgiving dishes and stuff. I just can't bring myself to do the can of mushroom soup.
No, I never was like a big fan of anything that has any kind of a cream soup base anyway. So that really kind of...
I don't think it's cream, Megan. It's kind of like, what is that stuff? It's like wallpaper paste or something.
Well, it's like creamy.
Yeah, creamy, right. Like chocolate.
Cream, it's cream of. cream of whatever that means. It's like a euphemism for we don't even want to know what.
But
but it's funny to me because like I've never... That food really hung on a little longer, I think, where I lived, just because we were, you know, we didn't get crunchy foods up there when other people were getting them. It was kind of like it took a while for stuff like that. So I hung on a lot longer where I was living in the small town, Upper Michigan. And man, I suffered because I just never have been into, you know, like green bean casserole to me. They pull that out on Thanksgiving. I'm like, I guess I have to serve this, but I'd really rather not. So
Alton Brown's recipe, baby. The best.
Is it good? All right. I'll be willing. You know, though, I remember as a kid, the one thing I liked, and also I remember there being sort of a debate about, you know, some people liked the frizzly onions on top and some people like Ritz crackers. You know, I'm a Ritz cracker girl. So instead of the French's onions on the top of the green bean casserole, my aunt always made it with like crumbled up Ritz crackers.
That might be like a religious denominational thing too. There's like Methodists top their casseroles with one thing and Baptists do something else.
Hey, now, you know, that's very possible. My family was Catholic. Maybe that's where the Catholics did it.
Roman Catholic Ritz crackers. I remember somebody recoiling in horror at a casserole at Vlogger in Chicago when I was six. She said, she couldn't believe, I don't know where she was from or where the casserole was from, but she looked and she said, are those cornflakes on top of that?
Oh, that's funny. Well, my stepmother is vegetarian and she's Seventh-day Adventist. So that there's like a long vegetarian sort of, it's like a very vegetarian culture and a tradition of vegetarianism. They have a lot of really inventive ways of making casseroles, like Special K loaf. So it's like meatloaf, but it's made from Special K.
Wow.
That was hard for me to like really wrap my brain around when I first took a slice.
I can't even imagine. Although I don't know that it's worse than tempeh or some of the processed
Well, you know, it's a grain that's basically been turned back into a mush. Like, it's just, you take something that's a cereal and you turn it back into sort of its pre, like, it's already digested version. It's
not this is what's fascinating to me. I mean, I don't want to be generalized and say that this is, you know, make it a gender thing. But I think for women, you know, for various reasons, and still overwhelmingly true today, you know, this was a major expression of our creativity. And it's where creativity meets practicality. And I mean, some people elevated it to great art. Someone just did, you know, the best they could to kind of get food on the table. But, you know, I think one of the interesting journeys of being a mom for me has been coming to peace with the amount of time and energy and imagination I have to put into feeding my family. And coming to peace with it and then trying to honor it, like, that's been really a significant achievement of my life. And tend to diminish it and think, oh, well, you know, it falls under the just a mom category of things.
Right.
And I wrote a little reflection on the blog last week about, you know, sort of this kind of spiritual awakening I had in the supermarket, which just tells you how much time I've spent in the supermarket. And I do. I'm there all the time. I have three boys. Two are teenagers now. I'm in the supermarket all the bleep time.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've hit the wall with it so many times where I just thought, God, this is hell. Why am I still here? Why am I always here? And then I just had this beautiful moment last week on Friday where I was just like, you know what? This has been my place. This has been the place
where
connect with community. I am here all the time, and I've kind of like broken through to the other side of it, you know. And you know, I have these conversations with the beggars and the people in the line. I'm, you know, I do a lot of people watching. I look at people's carts to see what's in there. You know, so it's been a major part of my life, and I'm trying to, you know, embrace that and go with it. It's interesting.
I'll include a link to that piece in the show notes as well, because I'm sure people would love to read it. And I totally agree. Like, it is that I feel like the early years of motherhood for me were marked by sort of resistance of the stuff that we kind of have to do, and then became acceptance. And now I really embrace it. And it's funny, last month, around the holiday and a little bit before, I got really busy with work and I was trying to get everything wrapped up before Christmas. And my husband just happened to have a really light workload. So he did the grocery shopping for almost the whole month. He did almost every, except for right at the holidays, he did almost every grocery store run. And at first I was like, wow, how liberating. I don't have to go to the store. Like, I can just give him a list and he goes and does it. This is great. I'm never going to do the store again. And then this week he was back at work on Monday and I had to go to the store. And when I got there, I was like, oh, I'm so glad to be back. Like, I was just so happy to have it be back in my domain. I think I had underestimated how much of my rhythm, you know, is caught up in being at the grocery store. And I don't want to use the word controlling, because I think that can be a very negative thing. But like, the kitchen really, John likes to cook, but it, like with your dad, when he cooks, it's a thing, right?
A big thing.
He's going to make like crepes or something. Like, he's not going to go in there and make pot roast for dinner. He's going to go in there and make something that everyone's going to be like,
and now I shall cook.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. For me, it's much more about the daily nurturing and the daily routine. And I just really have come to love it and embrace it. And it's, it is monotonous, but in a good way, you know, in the good way that things can be not, and see, monotonous again is one of those loaded words, but it's ritual.
It's ritual and it is repetitive. And I think there's something, you know, you do hit the wall with these things. There's days you just look and go, I can't, you know, I can't take it. I can't load and unload this dishwasher one more time. I'm going to go berserk. And then you got to load and unload the dishwasher one more time. And it is in that, you know, that repetition and habit that it starts to transcend the daliness of it, you know, not to over romanticize it, but, there's something about it. And it's been really neat to touch back to earlier generations. You know, we get very little passed down through our maternal heritage. My other obsession right now is, as you know, genealogy. And there's, you know, these women in our past get really kind of lost to time. They, you know, they give up their names, you know, we only even started recording their names and censuses in the last, you know, 150 years or so. So, but recipes get passed It's such a visceral thing. I mean, what can be more loving than nurturing your family through food? So to be able to do that through, you know, from generations ago, you know, this is a recipe that's, you know, great great grandma's whatever it is, chocolate cake, and we're making this for you on your birthday, and that's magic to me.
It is. Yeah, my sister recently made, and my sister, you know, has never really regarded herself as much of a cook, I guess. She gets the job done.
Right.
And I was at her house, and she was making spaghetti sauce. And I said, this just smells really familiar to me. And she said, oh, this is mom's spaghetti sauce. And my mom was also very much just a get the meal on the table cook. Like, she had a lot going on. She was divorced and ran a daycare. And so, like, dinner time to her was, like, crank it out. We had, like, five things that we ate.
Right.
And I never had thought about my mom's spaghetti sauce because it wasn't, like, what I would have thought of as real spaghetti. It was a Midwestern take on spaghetti.
Right.
So, like, ground beef and a lot of dried basil and stuff, like, you know, just very, very basic. But, oh, my gosh, the smell alone was like going back in time. And my sister said, oh, I got this recipe from Aunt Kay. And I said, I didn't even know this was a recipe. I didn't know this was a thing. You know, I didn't realize it had been like passed down. And I ate it and I was like, oh my gosh, like I'm making this from now on. This is my spaghetti. So that's the spaghetti I make. That's the sauce I make because it is my history. And, you know, maybe it's not authentic Italian, but it's authentic something.
Exactly. And we know, and it's, you know, the culture is so precious about food right now.
Yes. Oh gosh. Yes.
I mean, just really, and so there is a nice simplicity and an unpretentiousness about looking at some of these old recipes and the idea of just, you know, getting it done. But getting it done, you know, wasn't just sort of slapped together. I mean, there's a simplicity and a convenience and, you know, pragmatism, I guess, that's appealing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I went on a clean diet at last Lent, and it was great, and I'll do it again. But, oh, my God, I mean, that was... You can't do anything else, in my opinion, unless you have the money to buy, you know, all your prepared ingredients, or you have a personal chef doing it for you. I mean, all I was doing with my life was food, like prepping vegetables,
right.
You know, just to get the calories in, to have this pure kind of diet for the 40 days or whatever I did it. So yeah, it's, I think a lot of times looking at these old recipes and making them is a tonic against that.
I like that. And I think that sometimes when we make everything so precious, like you say, it just raises the stakes so much. And when people say, I can't cook, and I hear people say that, and, you know, sometimes I think that means I don't want to cook. And sometimes I think that means I don't know how to, like, I don't know what I'm doing. And I feel like the world I live in, the stakes are too high. Like, I don't know how to cook in the way I'm supposed to cook in 2013 or 2000, whatever year it is now, 2014.
Right.
And I'm kind of like, hey, what's wrong with a pot roast?
You wrote an essay about that a year or two ago that I just loved. I think it was maybe right at the opening of the Kitchen Hour.
Might have been. Yeah.
You know, inheriting that philosophy or that advice from your mom. Just, you know, oh yeah, it's okay. We can do a pot roast and have leftover sandwiches.
Right. Yeah. And it's okay if I don't know how to like cut up an onion right. That was another big sticking point for me.
Right.
I have no knife skills.
Like,
Oh,
it gets done. Come on, right?
Right.
I mean, human beings have been doing this for a long time, obviously,
exactly.
Or we wouldn't be here. Right.
Exactly. So I'm curious about some things. Have you run into any problems with ingredients not being the same? I'm thinking about things like flour or baking soda, like things that are in your mother-in-law's recipes that aren't translating.
So, well, you get like oleo, whatever that, you know.
Yes. Can you still buy that?
Oleo.
It's just Crisco,
margarine,
right?
Right? I think it's margarine.
Oh, is it margarine? Okay.
Yeah.
See, that's in all of those recipes in that book I have too. And I'm like, what is this?
And that's where I get off. Like, I'm just like, no, I'm not going to use margarine. I'm using butter. So,
right.
You know, I assume that a generation prior to her mother was using butter.
Exactly.
And I think a lot of the appeal, you know, when we go back just to divert back to the whole cream of mushroom, you know, canned soup thing, I think also for country people coming out of the Depression era and stuff, this was like the height of sophistication to be able to use some of these ingredients. You know, this was modern. So yeah, no, I get off at Oleo, I depart. And I always note in my blog journaling, like where I've, you know, I'll be faithful about reproducing her recipe, but if I make an alteration, I will, you know, make note of that.
Right.
So no Aleo. Cracks me up. She's got Cairo in almost everything. So Cairo, that's a good, and which down here was at Cairo. And you need to slow that down about
three. Oh, Cairo.
Cairo.
Got it. Okay.
You know, corn syrup.
I'm not sure a lot of people up here say it enough that I would even
know what it was.
No.
Yeah.
I mean, I know what it is, but I don't know that I've ever heard it said out loud.
Yeah. No, Cairo, you know, Cairo pie, Cairo nut pie, which is pecan pie. So things like that. And then also, like, she'll have noted, you know, these are notations like, you know, the pound sign, number two can of tomato, you know, whatever it is. So right. Then I had to go to Google and go, what the heck was a number two? You know, what was it right. two can, you know, and how many ounces that is that translates to today. So little things like that. It's been really interesting to me to occasionally I'll have to go and Google the recipe and see if it's somewhere else just to get clear on, like, okay, what kind of nut does she mean when she says nuts or, you know, something like that. And it's like, you know, to go back to the genealogy analogy, like her cooking DNA is frighteningly identical to Paula Deen's. So like,
okay.
Yeah, it's like a lot of her recipes will be just one ingredient off or one, you know, they were obviously cooking out of the same Great American, cookbook, and a lot of Pioneer Woman's, recipes, you know, seem to have that kind of, it's a lot of butter,
a lot of butter
going on here.
Yeah. I think my tipping point with Paula Deen was when I saw her fry butter in oil and I was like, well, an aisle. She fried butter in an aisle. But I was watching and I'm like, did you just put a pat of butter into oil? Like, what? So no. This is dinner.
If I find that recipe in the steno pad, I'm just going to quietly take it out.
I mean, I love butter and I love aisle, but
come on, right?
Right. And the other one that killed me was a cracker salad, and it was saltine crackers mushed up, mixed with mayonnaise.
Oh.
And some pieces of celery. And I was like, I don't think you can call it a salad. That to me doesn't, I mean, technically, I suppose it does have salad dressing on it, but.
Wow. You know, but I think everybody's got this one like food that they know is gross and they're probably embarrassed to share with somebody. But
yes.
Like in Patrick's family, his family had a thing. This sounds so trashy, and they were not at all, you know, they were very respectable, blue-collar people. But they had a thing. He remembers his parents eating what they would call a supreme, which is like, if I get this right, peanut butter and mayonnaise sandwich.
Oh, yeah. I've heard of that before.
Oh, have you? I didn't even know that was a thing. It shouldn't be a
thing. Yeah.
But anyway, you know, like, that was their thing that they loved it. And, you know, I bet if we just really got honest, it'd be something like, some guilty pleasure, whatever it is. I'm trying to think what mine would be. That's just gross. You know, if I told you about, well, you know what? I like tinned asparagus, or like canned.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So canned asparagus mashed on toast is one of my favorite things.
Wow. That sounds awful.
That,
but you know, maybe it's not, awful. I don't know.
But so like, something I grew up with, right?
So. That's you know, and speaking of like that era too, with the casserole foods, the church picnic era, and maybe I don't go to church picnics as much as I did growing up, or hardly ever, so maybe that's still being, these things are still being served and I just don't know it, right. But there would always be, you know, you'd see the table kind of build out, and at one end there would be the people who just bought a bucket of fried chicken and like, you know, and like the meatballs and stuff like that, and then down at the dessert end was always such an interesting study in sort of like that 60s, 70s kind of food. And I remember the one that killed me was, I don't even really know what was in it, but it was a bunch of colored marshmallows inside of some kind of fluff. And it was just, I think it might've been that whipped. I think it actually might've been whipped marshmallow with marshmallow chunks. And I was so grossed out. I mean, just disgusted by it, but all the other kids thought it was amazing because it was basically just pure sugar.
Pure sugar.
So they would have a huge plate full of pure sugar and they'd, you know, my mom would be like, here, take some of this, you know, fluff or whatever it was called. And I was like, no, mom.
Yeah, marshmallows are persistent. I that's one of the confessions I make at Thanksgiving. My kids love the marshmallow top. Well, I like it too. I like the marshmallow top sweet potato casserole. So I do that.
Yeah, I would. I can't. For me, sweet potatoes are already bordering on a little too sweet.
Yeah.
I like to put salt on them. Like, it's to me, it's like I got to bring it back to the savory side a little bit. But I also think that that's maybe one of those things for me that, like, in my mind, a sweet potato is a vegetable, therefore it should be savory. Like, it's one of those weird, like, do not cross this line, but it's just an association. Like, my sister used to make sweet potato pie, and I was always like, ooh, that sounds gross. Well, it tastes just like pumpkin pie, which I think is delicious. But in my mind, like, pumpkin pie was dessert. Like, pumpkin was dessert. Right. Sweet potato was side. So sometimes you have to, like, I have to get over those associations that I made very strongly when I was little. So, you know, I have peanut butter and butter sandwiches. Why not peanut butter and mayonnaise?
Peanut butter and butter?
Yeah, that's delicious.
What? And you're complaining about Paula Deen frying butter in oil?
Well, but see, this is it's not fried.
That's gratuitous. Well, now it makes it, you need to grill it.
Oh, it just makes, you know what? That would probably be amazing because it makes it just like slide down your throat. You know how peanut butter sandwiches can get a little sticky?
Yeah.
This just eliminates that and gives it this nice, creamy,
I haven't had one of those in a long time. When my kids leave this house, I don't ever want to see peanut butter again. Seriously, I'm so sick of maybe it'll become a transcendent thing like the supermarket. Maybe I'll like just go through the other side of peanut butter. But I've been making peanut butter sandwiches in their lunch, like, no kidding, every day that they've been in school. I'm like, do y'all not get bored with this? Nope, not peanut butter.
Well, that's what I ate every single day from, you know, kindergarten through, I don't know, sixth grade. I had a peanut butter sandwich, a banana, and a baggie of crackers every day for all those years. And I didn't care. That's what I wanted. That's how I liked it. You know, if my mom had started slipping something else, then I would have been like, what?
What's this? Yeah, my dad would send me, like, occasionally my dad would be in charge of packing my lunches, and he'd send, like, the weirdest things that were, like, you know, smelly, like curried things. And it would just be like, oh God, you know, God, no, I'm weird enough. You know, my family's weird enough without this curried tuna salad thing. Like, come on. Can't we ever have white bread?
Oh, that's so funny. Oh, you know, just reminded me of something. Maybe you'll know what this is, that my mom did send to school with me one time, and I thought it was cat food, but it wasn't. It was some kind of, I think this used to be more popular. It was I don't know if it was potted meat, though, because I think it was, like, in the deli section. I think it was, like, bologna that was all liverwurst. Chopped up. No, it wasn't liverwurst. It was bologna, but it was, like, it was all pre-done for you. So it was, like, chopped up. I think there was pimentos in it. I'll have to look that up. If I can figure out what it is, I'll put it in. And I think it was called sandwich spread.
Oh, yeah.
That was, like, what it was called.
Oh, wow. Sandwich spread. I actually passed a jar. Well, and there's a sandwich spread thing that's a mayonnaise-based sort of condiment.
Okay.
And I actually passed a jar of that in my supermarket the other day and was shocked because I thought that was like just a Newfoundland thing. But I guess it was one of those 50s things. It's like McDonald's secret sauce. Like it's probably, Thousand Island dressing mixed with, you know, mayo or whatever. But yeah.
Okay, wait, I just found it on Google. It is bologna. What I had was bologna sandwich spread. Okay. It's got a mayonnaise base. It's got bologna, onion, jerkin pickles. Or gherkin pickles. I always called them gherkin. Well, I probably shouldn't have in my house, but this one calls for cheese. I don't think there was cheese in mine growing up, and then spicy mustard.
Wow.
See,
those things, do you ever look at like old, you know, pick up at yard sales, those old 1950s recipe books called it horrid food photography.
Yes.
Sickly looking, molded.
The colors are always weird, and like everything's got this reddish hue to it, or
I
pink
feel like-
kind of.
So much want to do a party. We actually did, my husband turned 50 in September and we did a mid-century themed party and I invited people to bring, you know, like what gelatin salads and whatever, little canapé finger food. So yeah, we had quite a vision.
That's so funny. Cause, for a couple of friends of mine, and I have been talking about having like a regular, either progressive dinner or just like a potluck, but we're all those foods, you know.
Yeah.
The gross. And I'm sure it doesn't look half as gross when it's not
washed
that
out.
Photography.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
it was even worse when it was black and white, too.
Right. Somebody did bring liverwurst, and there's no way you can photograph that.
No, probably not. No. But, you know, it's funny to me how our tolerance has even changed. So, like, let's pretend, you know, you're your mother or your mother-in-law, and it's 40 years ago. And you're looking at a recipe book and all the pictures look disgusting. I guess whatever you turn out by comparison looks great. You know, compare that to now.
Like, well, I never thought of that.
Yeah. Now you go on, everything looks amazing. And then you make it and you're thinking, well, it's all right.
Wow. Wow, that's so profound. Because I never, and I don't know, I guess in my imagination, they were just turning out these pale, washed up, you know, timbales. Like funny. The movie Pleasantville, where everyone's in black.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. That's an interesting point. Because now, yeah, the bar is like way, you know.
Way high.
It's crazy. And the other interesting thing is now, like, I was thinking about my relationship with cookbooks. I grew up with cookbooks. And, like The Joy of Cooking, which was probably like the 1960s edition, I guess, in our house, you know, the cloth bound with the ribbons sticking out of it. I mean, that was our family Bible. We had, you know, that's where report cards were tucked into that, and drawings and ticket stubs and pressed flowers from funerals and proms. And there'd be notes all up and down the sides. And I used to sit, it was a great book to read. And, you know, it wasn't the best cookbook in the world. It was more of a resource book.
Yes, I agree.
You know, the recipes were hit and miss, but just that it was fascinating reading. And I remember being a young kid and just poring over the stories of that, the little anecdotes about the family cook making strudel with a tablecloth and how to do a clam bake, you know, and all these things that were just so fascinating to me. And I was thinking about how appealing that was. And, you know, that was... I have to go Google the name of that, the authors of Joy of Cooking. Like that, now it's all celebrity cooks. And now it's all about the individual. And you're not just, you know, buying into a way of eating, you're buying into the whole lifestyle. And, you know, they've really taken over. And where it used to be all about, you know, just the food.
Right. And just recipes that worked. And like you said, sometimes it didn't. I got a Joy of Cooking, and we also grew up with that. That and the Betty Crocker one, and then I think A Better Homes and Gardens were the gingham cover, I believe, red one was – those were our three big ones. But I got – when I got married, I got the Joy of Cooking, whatever edition was out then. And it's – you know, it's dinged up. It's in my – it's the one constant. It's in my kitchen all the time. And I don't always use it for the quick and dirty recipe because, you know, it's huge, A – it doesn't like always hold open well. I'll be like dashing back and, you know, so sometimes I'll just have something up on my iPad just to like follow along with really quick. But if I want to know something about a cut of meat or something about a vegetable or something about all the different things I could do with one cut of meat or one vegetable, that's the book I turn to. It's got everything in it. And like you said, it's not about the writer. Yeah, I don't know who the writers were. I want to say one of them's name was Irma.
It was Irma Roth. She has a German last. She was from St. Louis. I know that much. And then
the fact that I actually knew her name was Irma with an I, that surprises me. I must have just looked at the cover and it stuck.
So many times, yeah.
Right. But that was sort of, you know, beside the point. And Betty Crocker wasn't even a real person. Although she was sort of like the original celebrity house homemaker, except fake.
She was like the fake icon. I know.
Yeah.
We get confused. She feels like my grandmother or something. There's the Fanny Farmer book I still use. I have very few cookbooks now because I just find them inconvenient. You know, it's sad to say. I like them for reading and looking over, but when it comes to having them in the kitchen, I'm like, yeah, I want to, you know, something that I can prop up and run with. Mark Bittman's How to Cook Everything app is my Joy of Cooking. I could, and the recipes are very reliable. But he's also just, it's a great resource. Like, here, I've got this, you know, cut of meat I bought on sale. Now what? What do I do with this? You know, or I need a good basic roast chicken recipe or, you know, just those. He's got lots of basic stuff and then branches out from there.
It's an app, huh?
It's an app. And the way it's done is really just fantastic.
I need that. Yeah, I'm going to get that. Mark Bittman, How to Cook Anything. Is that what it's called?
Everything. And it's updated a lot. So, and it's just good. You know, he's just good.
Yeah, that sounds great. That's, you know, I find myself with all of the, like a stack of, because I still print things out because I tend to make a mess when I cook. Mm-hmm. So I'll like find a recipe online, I'll print it out, then I'll take it and spread it out. I'm also horrible at following recipes. And it's not that I'm illiterate. It's just that
you're a rebel.
I get, I'm obedient. I just get, I'm forgetful. So like, for example, I'll do the first step and then I lose track of where I was and then I go back and I have to start over. So it's like, it takes me a while, you know, of reading these recipes to really get them. And I have to just internalize them. But that's also something that's come with time. Now that I think about it, when I was first trying to really learn how to cook, recipes were impossible to follow because I didn't understand the logic behind anything. Right. I didn't get why you would sear meat, for example, before you would stew it or why you would do any of these other things. When you don't know why you're doing something, it's really hard to remember to do it.
Right. And it's so easy to take it for granted. Like, I had just a beautiful moment watching my son, my middle son, cook one time. This is a couple years ago. He was still quite young. I was watching him. I wrote about it. I don't remember what it was now. Like, you know, talking about knife skills or something like that. You know, trying to cut something or dice something. Maybe just cream, butter, and sugar. Like something that I just took for granted. And I was watching what an effort, like how deliberate he had to be. You know, just the motor skills and just, and I, it really set me back because I thought, wow, I really take this for granted. Again, this, you know, this thing that I hate to do and it's just a chore. And then you realize like, this is a skill set. Like I really got a major investment in this and I may as well celebrate it, you know, like by watching, even my husband, you know, when we started living together, he didn't cook. And I would say, well, here's, you know, saute this onion. Well, he didn't know what saute was, you know, like, what do you mean? What's the difference between a chop and a mince? So, you know, it's those kinds of things that it's an acquired skill set and it's a wealth of experience and to be able to deviate and improvise and, or come back to a recipe and go, oh, it needs this, it needs that. Like those are things that, you know, I'm pretty fluent in now.
Yeah. That's a really nice way of looking at it because I do definitely think that, and again, total generalization, but moms tend to be the ones who overtake this part, you know, take this part of, over. Mm-hmm. And we tend to think one of two things, either you got it or you don't, like you can cook or you can't, which is no, you start off not, and then you can, but it's like, there's a long time between the not being able to cook and the being able to, but if it's something that you do every day or every third day or, you know, a few times a week or whatever it is, and you consistently do it, you're going to end up and think of all the meals you put that you make and put in front of people, like all of those hours of practice, there's very few things that we put as much time into and as practice into as putting dinner on the table and as cooking. So of course, by the time we've been doing it for 10 years or however long, we get good at it. You don't start that way.
Right.
But you do get good at it. And I remember when I used to come into the kitchen and every single time it was like starting over. When I was, you know, newly married, every single time I walked into the kitchen and thought, what should I make for dinner? It was like being a freshman in high school again, you know, just sitting there going, Well, they still happen, but
I get into ruts where I'm just like, I don't remember what we eat. I'm just in a grocery store going, what do people eat? I don't remember.
Well, when I start to get that way, I literally will just pull out some garlic and start chopping it up because there's almost nothing I make that doesn't have garlic in it. So I figure by the time I get done doing that, I'll have some idea of what I'm... something will come to me. I don't know.
I like that.
I'll just, I don't know,
eat the garlic. Lots of wine and start chopping garlic.
Yeah. You need those like a peg almost, or, you know, like a, not a trigger, but you know, like a, it's just that thing that you always tie to your time doing something. And for me, getting out an onion and a clove of garlic is like the first step.
Perfect.
So it just gets me in that mood. And yeah, the glass of wine most of the time. Well, for sure.
You know, not having all sons and their dad who doesn't really cook, it's interesting to me to see, you know, which of them have an aptitude and interest. And they all three of them seem very interested in cooking. And as they get older, they're more, you know, they're more enthusiastic about jumping up to, you know, can I make this? Can I make that? They want to experiment a little bit. And so I'm hoping that they're going to grow up to be, both kinds of cooks, the cooks who can do the big production cooking, but also are going to have a, you know, major role in nourishing their own families and getting it done.
Yes, me too. Because I think that, you know, I think the sad consequence of women moving away from doing the household kinds of things, which totally understandable, like there had to be the tipping point where it was like, hey, you know, we need to branch out. This can't be our only role, blah, blah, blah. But the sad consequence was that there was no one left to then take it up and run with it. And so there's this whole generation of kids, boys and girls, who then just didn't learn. But I feel like now we have this real opportunity to kind of, to now teach it to the boys as well. So that, because I love domestic tasks, but they're not only mine.
Sure.
And you can embrace domesticity, but split it with your spouse or the other people in your house.
Right.
And which is a good way to ease into talking about your book, because the subtitle of your book is it Field Notes from a Semi-Domesticated Life?
I think so. Yeah. That sounds good.
You're like, that should be. If it's not already. Okay, so the book we think
field
is...
Field Notes from a Semi-Domesticated Life. Yes, that is.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so it's Planting Dandelions, Field Notes from a Semi-Domesticated Life. It's also the tagline on your blog. You should really know this. Right. Just kidding. I'm horrible at remembering my taglines. So how did... tell me about that tagline. Did it come from your decision to sort of surrender a bit to this life that you never, you know, thought you would have?
Yeah, I think... I wanted to express that the idea of field notes, you know, I felt like through my blogging, my experience of raising a family, which is how I kind of found my nonfiction voice, I realized that I was taking field notes. You know, I felt like I was embedded in this, you know, in the field. I used to mm-hmm. compare myself to Jane Goodall living with apes, which is not far off when you're living with toddlers, as you well know. And so the field notes part, I wanted to, you know, write as though I were reporting from this experience, from deep within this experience. That was an unexpected experience for me in lots of ways, living in the suburbs, living in America. It seems silly now to look back and say that I was ambivalent about motherhood and stuff. It seems hard to imagine me going in any other direction, but I was, you know, or at least I humored myself, you know, I like to entertain the idea that I was going to go off and have this other life that didn't involve having kids. And so, yeah, I wanted to report on this strange experience I was having as a stranger in a strange land. And then the semi-domesticated was a nod to, you know, the part that stays, the me in the middle of the we, you know, the part that doesn't subscribe to it. This is the part of me that still says, entertains the what if, and, you know, well, maybe I'm not so into this. And I always felt that as moms, you know, it's such a deep, immersive experience and all consuming. And I feel like if you're not in touch, at least with that part of yourself that could just walk away sometimes, which is a frightening thing to say and to hear, I think, because it sounds like, what, you know, what would that mean? And of course, I don't mean it literally, but I mean, if you're not in touch with that part of you that didn't sign on.
Right.
And I think you've really lost a little part of your wild soul. And so I wanted to honor that and say, like, in the midst of all this belonging and this immersive experience, there's still a me. There's still a wild part of me that didn't sign on, can't be quite tamed. And I wanted to, you know, incorporate that into my reporting of that experience as a mom and a wife.
Well, and I think that when you recognize that there's that part of you, and we all have it, what some of us is more deeply buried than others, but we've all got it. When you recognize it and honor it, then you're choosing, you know, then it's a choice.
Right.
It's not just something that was
blind
that you're forced into, or that is just the way it is and you have to. And not like we're actually, I mean, it's not like I literally get up in the morning and think, now today I choose not to run away from my family.
Right. Although.
I mean, you know, most of the time anyway.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No.
But just knowing that there are other lives we could have led and that by in some way, this is the one that we embraced. It's an interesting way of looking at it. I like that.
Sure. This time is very intense and mm-hmm. motherhood and being part of family. It's everything right now. You know, it's just these are the years. But I look at my mom, you know, and my dad died in 2001. They divorced before that. She lives alone, has lived alone for many years now. She has a wonderful, rich life and travels and great friends. But her life is nothing like the life that must have seemed eternal. Like my life today
right.
seems like, oh, it's always going to be like this. You know, mm-hmm. this is the way it always was and always will be. And yet it's really in the blink of an eye, it's not going to be like this. So I think it's really important too, to just stay in touch with, you know, the other tangents of self that that still have interests and passions and curiosities outside of this time.
You're right. It's such a short time. And not only that, but it changes even within, you know, like I was thinking the other day about now the fact that I have two teenagers in the house, two big boys, and then my daughter. Somehow she's not a baby. I don't really know how that happened. Yeah. She was a baby and now she's not. I mean, my life is so much freer and easy. Even though I've got a lot going on and there's a lot of moving parts, it was only a few years ago, a very short time ago, that I could not go to the grocery store without taking all of my kids.
Oh, God.
I could not do anything. I mean, I couldn't make a meal without having a baby hanging on my leg. I couldn't. That was just like yesterday. You know, it was such a short time of my life when it was so intense and like where I'd have that feeling like I wanted to like jump out of my skin and crawl up a wall and like run away, but there was nowhere to go. I don't know if you ever had that feeling.
Yeah.
Like I want something to happen. I want to go and do something, and but there's nowhere to go.
All these children hanging on.
And there's nothing to do, right? And yeah. But now like I can't. Gosh, now I can go. I can do. It's amazing, really, how short that time was. But it felt like I was never going to get out of it.
Well, and you know, I hate to become like the old lady and the matron.
Nobody wants to be that old lady, right? But we all are at some point.
Yeah, I do feel compelled. Like I do want to tell people not. I don't want to tell people like the, you know, don't get mad at your kid, you know, because it's so quickly. But I do want to say like, yes, it's hard. I want to validate. It's really hard. It's physically hard. I mean, all those little tasks that were so, so hard to do with kids hanging off of you or strollers and car seats to navigate and nap times to get around. So I want to like validate that to, you know, younger moms, but also say, it is a blink of a time. You know, what is it? Gretchen Rubin says the days are long.
The days are long and then the years are short.
Years are short. Beautiful way of putting it. So it's perfect. So, and I wanted, you know, writing the book, I was emerging from those early years. So I also wanted to be able to paint a realistic portrait of what all, you know, those years of forming a family, of really consolidating, becoming the we, you know, they're tough. Yeah. They're wonderful and they're happy, but there's a lot of struggles in those years. There's a lot of drama. Mm-hmm. For us, there certainly was. I think for most people I know, just while you're settling into that identity, and you know, lots of families don't come through those first dozen years intact, or they come through, you know, as a different kind of family on the other side of it. It's just a really rich period of growing and changing and shifting, and it's just remarkable to think that, you know, few years in less time than I've been in it, you know.
Yeah.
I'll be on the other side of that.
Yeah, it is.
Right now with the teenagers, it's interesting. I'm sort of back in a more intense period of parenting that I haven't, like, you know, through the little years and the middle years, I came to a place where I was just kind of, I could coast for a while. I was like,
yeah, there's definitely a break. You can take a breath.
Yeah, like, I know how to do this. I got this.
Yeah.
And then suddenly, you know, here we go. Oh, I don't got this anymore. Now I've got to like suddenly, I'm reading books about parenting again. I haven't done that in years, you know, or, you know, actively looking for advice and information and resources. Not that we're having a particularly challenging time, but it's just, it's new. I don't know.
It's new.
I don't know the game anymore. Yeah.
I was just telling, I recorded a podcast earlier today with Jennifer Fink, who writes a blog called Building Boys, and she's got four boys, two of whom are teenagers. And I was just telling her that, you know, when my son is a sophomore, when he started high school, it was like me starting high school. It was like brand new. I feel like one of the moms at the moms group with like the 6 week old, you know, the first 6 week old going, Hey, how do I do this? And also there's that temptation to do what other people say you should do again, which I have not experienced in years. I've become to a place where I'm so confident that it's really hard to find myself making decisions and then thinking, wait, am I doing that because I think that's the right thing to do? Or am I doing that because I'm not really sure of myself? And I feel like the rest of the world thinks that that's the way you parent a teen. And so it's a lot of rediscovery.
Yeah. It's really, it's got me, like I say, having to be on my game again and really thinking in a more active way than I have had to, you know,
and the stakes are higher now.
Stakes feel higher. And I don't know, in some ways it's also coming back to that, intense nurturing period. I guess it does parallel, you know, babyhood or infancy in the sense that there's just a lot of transitional stuff going on. And my answer to that has been to just, you know, really hang on tight. And it's more, you know, my focus is parenting right now, is mothering in a way that hasn't been for several years. Not that I was just neglecting, but like I say, it wasn't the front and center thing.
Right.
So it's interesting to go back into that space for a little while. And I guess what I know now, you know, is that it's not forever. That's really
right.
And that I can do this. And this is one thing I would like to say to younger moms. Like, you know, it's, yes, it asks a lot of you. It really asks too much of you those years, but you don't have to do it forever.
Exactly. I like that. And how old are your sons now?
So my eldest has just turned 15, and I've got a brand new minted 13-year-old.
Nice.
And then the baby is 9, going to be 10 this spring, which he'll be in the double digits.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's funny, my 10-year-old, wow, this has been a big year for him, and he's got, so I've got, you know, the boys, my daughter's 4, and then 8, 10, 14, and 16 are the boys. And the 8 and 10-year-olds have always been buddies. And my two sets of boys are like 2 years apart, then there's a break, and then 2 years apart. Mm-hmm. So it's a nice little, you know, nice little couplings, I guess. And both sets have always been good friends. And my younger set has, they have male cousins and other friends that they share. Like, I don't know if any of your boys have ever had shared friends, but sibling friends, or like the kids who are in the middle between them, and they kind of all go together, you know?
Yeah, I love it.
But William, who's 10, he's just on his own trajectory, and it's, he's still nice to them. He still wants to play with them. In a lot of ways, he still wants to be a little kid, but I can see like, whoa, he's big, you know, he's bigger.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, this is the year he's took a big leap. Yeah. So it's a little sad because I love having those, that 8 to 9, that 7, 8, 9 year old age is so, it's so sweet.
But isn't it funny? Like I look at my youngest, who's almost 10, and I look back at photos or even, you know, blog pieces I wrote about my eldest when he was that same age. I'm like, what? I was right. You know, I thought my firstborn was so grown up at 10.
Right.
And the baby is just babied, you know, it's the baby. Come on, right?
Like, right.
I mean, it's just cliche.
It is. And Will's the middle child, so he kind of gets it on both. Like, he was the baby until one day I realized he wasn't, right? But my daughter will probably always be the baby.
It's a sweet place to be. My husband's his family, and he loved it. I was the eldest, and I mostly loved that. So with the unknown for us is our middle. We have a middle son who's delightful, but he's quite an enigma, and neither of us have, you know, any experience of what being a middle child is like. So he gets to
miss he'll school that. You.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I want to wrap up now, but I want to make sure to talk about anything that we missed that you really are dying to get out there. Are there any, you know, anything you've written lately that you're particularly proud of that I could, you know, share in the notes or anything like that?
Well, I think it's timely to be talking about just food and all of that stuff because I did do that supermarket piece, the precious piece on my blog right now. And, you know, that diving in, embracing the reality of what it takes to keep your family together. And, you know, that's kind of where my passion lies throughout most of my work. I can't think of any other kind of pending things. I'm working on a novel, which has many similar themes to what we've talked about, you know, to what I wrote about in my memoir about the intersection of wilderness and domesticity. But that's in early days yet, so.
I can't wait to hear how that develops. And I have to tell you, so I'm looking at your post right now about the grocery store, which I will link to. But there's a paragraph here, which I'm going to read it. This is totally what was in my mind when I was talking about the time you put in and the expertise that you gain. So we totally had this, our great minds were thinking alike. So here's from Karen's piece. There's a theory called the 10,000 hour rule, which suggests that the 10,000 hour mark is the point at which the regular practice of a discipline crosses over to mastery. At a conservative average of 3 hours a week for the past 15 years, plus maybe 500 hours for the 10 years before I had a family, I've got about 3,000 hours logged in at grocery shopping. That's a long way from 10K, but in the last year or so, something changed. I stopped trying to escape supermarket hell. I surrendered. Mm-hmm. Love it. So it's even grocery shopping can be an art form.
Right.
Something that you master. I love that.
Right.
Well, Karen, this has been delightful. Again, in the show notes, which I will give you guys the link to that in a few minutes, you can find a link to her blog, and I'll link up all your social media accounts and all that stuff as well. And I'll put a link to this piece in particular and your book and all the other good stuff that you want to know about her. Karen, thank you so much for being on the show.
Hey, it was my pleasure.
This has been great. Thanks so much for listening to this week's episode of the Home Hour Podcast. It's going to take me a little while to get used to saying that, and maybe it's going to take you a while to get used to hearing it. But either way, I'm really glad you stuck around. And I hope you love the new show and all the new things that are coming your way. Again, I would love it if you would leave me a review or a rating in iTunes. I'm going to leave instructions on how to do that in the show notes. And you're also going to find a bunch of information about Kieran and how to find her online and what we talked about in today's show notes. So again, those are at thehappiesthome.com/episode19. Look for a new episode next Thursday and have a great week.